Hello everybody, and welcome to today's video. Thanks to the fine folk over on Patreon who voted for this subject, we're going to look briefly at, well, maybe not the five worst admirals of all time, because that is a very subjective thing, but at least five of the worst admirals of all time, at least the five worst that I could think of. If there's other candidates you'd like to put in, then feel free to. Now, notably, we're not going to include some admirals who appear quite often in different people's lists, such as poor old Admiral Rozjestvenskiy, because, well, yes, his naval career did end with the catastrophic defeat at Tsushima, but as I've covered in both the videos on the 2nd Pacific Squadron and the video on Admiral Rozjestvenskiy himself, he was actually a fairly good, if not brilliant, naval officer who was dealt one of the worst possible hands ever, and the fact that the Russian fleet even managed to make it to Tsushima to be defeated in the first place was something of a minor miracle that many other admirals would have failed to do. So he's not on this list, because he doesn't deserve to be on it, because you do have to remember, just because you suffered a catastrophic defeat does not necessarily make you a terrible admiral. You can do pretty much everything within your power right and still lose. The world is sadly not a particularly fair place. However, there are some people who absolutely do deserve to be on this list because, well, given their attitudes and or lack of competence, the battle was already lost the moment they put to sea or ordered people to sea. Now, I say ordered people to sea because a slightly, perhaps arguable inclusion is going to be the first one that I'm going to discuss, and that is King Philip II of Spain. Now, he technically was not an admiral. He did not lead men into combat aboard his ships. However, I feel like he has to go on this list because he is responsible for not one, not two, but three Spanish armadas, and all three ended in disaster. Now, there are numerous reasons why those various armadas ended in disaster, but a very large chunk of them rest on Philip II. He was a classic autocrat and micromanager, basically trying to run the entire Spanish Empire from his own desk. And unfortunately, that meant that a lot of the time, a combination of his own arrogance and, well, the fact that he was the king of the largest empire in the world at the time, meant that it was almost impossible to tell him no. And when few people did, he usually didn't listen to them. And so he ordered the first Spanish Armada. This is the Spanish Armada, the one that everyone probably knows about. And despite the Marquis de Santa Cruz, who actually was a pretty competent naval leader, dying partway through its preparations after having expressed doubts as to whether or not it could actually be done, and despite the Duke of Medina Sidonia, his replacement, also telling Philip, one, I don't think this can be done. Two, I'm not a naval officer. Please don't make me lead a fleet because that's probably going to end very badly. Philip ignored all of this and insisted that no, God would provide. God would bless this expedition. He had permission from the Pope. This was a divine mission, essentially a slightly floaty version of a crusade. And he was going to win. And he was going to win by coming up with the single most convoluted naval plan in recorded history relative to the actual capabilities of the Navy at the time. And much like Napoleon, several hundred years later, he decided that, well, because he had said so, ships would be able to sail at a consistent speed and a consistent rate, and messages would be able to travel at consistent speed and a consistent rate, and there would be this very complicated picking up of the Duke of Parma's army and ferrying them back to England and sailing up and down the channel, despite what the weather and the English had to say about this, because reasons. Rather unsurprisingly, it all went horribly wrong, and although the Armada didn't lose too many ships to the English fleet itself, it did take a fair bit of damage, ended up having to go all the way around the UK, although the UK didn't exist at that point, so the British Isles, at which point storms intervened and wrecked about half of it. So, most people at this point would have learned their lesson and said, okay, maybe sending a gigantic fleet of ships under a commander who isn't really an experienced naval officer to invade a country that is full of very angry people who's like sailing around on ships and shooting at them and or stealing the contents of other ships is probably not a good idea. And most deeply religious people, having invoked the blessing of God on a scheme of theirs, and having seen the natural elements completely pulverize their fleet, might have decided that maybe this was God's way of saying no. Philip II, however, decided that clearly all that had happened was he hadn't been praying hard enough, and so a few years later he would send out a second Spanish armada, and this time with the brilliant tactical innovation of sending it out even later in the year when it was even more likely that there were going to be storms. Now, granted, this time he did actually give command to a fairly experienced naval officer, Martin de Padilla y Manrique, who was exceptionally unlucky in this case because he was a fairly competent naval officer. He'd done a pretty decent job against the English Armada, and he would go on to have two other fairly major naval victories to his name, just none of them involved Philip's continued attempts to invade England. So poor old Martin de Padilla, as we're going to call him for the minute, began putting together his force, facing many of the same challenges the Duke of Medina-Sidonia had faced in terms of insufficient funding, insufficient supplies, and a lot of people being assigned to the fleet who were sick or otherwise injured, which shockingly caused further waves of disease, which meant even more men were mobilized. Then the English found out about it, took one look at the whole thing, and when it was reported that the second Spanish Armada was about to sail, they took one look at the weather and went, no one would be mad enough to sail now, given it's autumn. And then the storms did indeed arrive. The Armada was forced to stay put in port, and during this time Philip decided, okay, maybe going off to invade Ireland, which had been the point of this particular expedition, was a little bit too ambitious. So instead they were just told to go and sail and seize the French port of Brest, which was a little bit closer and might act as a useful staging point for further invasions of England, or indeed Ireland, at some point in the future. The Armada waited for a break in the weather, duly set sail, and got scattered and mostly sunk by storms. Yeah, who could have saw that one coming? Back over in England, reports that the Spanish had in fact been mad enough to sail reached them, and slightly worried by rumours that a large Spanish force had landed in Ireland, and that Ireland had then risen against the English, who at that point were ruling the place. Well, they sent a fleet out, and all they found was scattered wreckage and bodies that had washed up from the Bay of Biscay, and one very lost Spanish ship, which they promptly captured and confirmed that yes, in fact, the Spanish had sailed, and yes, in fact, storms had smashed them all up again. Now, you'd think that two supposedly divinely blessed fleets, both badly smashed up by storms, would be enough of a hint, but not for Philip, because the next year, poor old Martin de Padilla was put in charge of a third armada, which was given the job of doing the same thing as the previous year's armada, i.e. sailing up to Ireland and trying to support various rebel groups there. Poor old Padilla did his best, put together a fairly large fleet, sailed out again, and they seem to have been afforded a bit of an opportunity, because a large Anglo-Dutch force had sailed to first try and destroy the Spanish fleet in harbour, which it had failed to do, also to try and capture the Azores Islands, which it had failed to do, and intercept and destroy the Spanish treasure fleet, which it had also failed to do. But at the moment it was all the way out in the Atlantic, and therefore the English coast was undefended. Except once again their orders were changed at the last minute, now looking to occupy either part of Cornwall or part of West Wales, whichever they could get to, instead of going for Ireland. And once again, they sailed in mid to late autumn. And so, to the surprise of pretty much nobody who's listening at this point, they ran into massive storms. And in fact, several ships managed to contrive to explode in the middle of said massive storms. This time, English intelligence had actually completely failed, and they had no idea the Spanish were coming. At least that is until various bits of wreckage and indeed entire Spanish ships badly damaged started randomly showing up on various English and Welsh beaches, to the great confusion of pretty much everybody. Most of those were understandably looted. One showed up in a Welsh harbour where a rather comedic standoff took place, because the ship in question, which was actually a commandeered Dutch vessel, had nowhere near the force to actually land and didn't have any boats to effect a landing anyway, and they didn't particularly want to go aground. But equally, the locals and the local militia didn't have any boats suitable to head out there and capture it. So the ship just hung around for a bit, repaired its masts and rigging, sailed out, and eventually got captured by an English squadron that was patrolling elsewhere, but that's another story. And it turned out that the same storm had broken up the Anglo-Dutch fleet on its way back, to such an extent that the two fleets actually passed straight through each other without noticing. except for a few isolated groups of Anglo-Dutch ships which came across a few even more isolated Spanish ships and captured them, but the vast majority of the Anglo-Dutch fleet arrived back in England to be told that, hey, you just sailed straight through another Spanish armada, to which they went, no, we didn't, yes, you did, no, we didn't, yes, you did, no, we didn't, yes, you did, they're all over there. Or at least what's left of them is. Oh, yeah. How on earth did we miss that lot? Oh, well, better go and pick up the stragglers. There was also a somewhat belated mobilisation when they realised actually there had been a fairly large Spanish fleet off the English coast. And there was a rather funny standoff where one contingent of Spanish troops did actually manage to land on English soil in a vaguely organised manner, set themselves up in a little fortified revetment, were immediately surrounded by a large number of militia who kind of looked at them and went, I wonder what that lot are doing here. I guess we should hang around just in case they try and move anywhere. And then there was a rather awkward standoff because, well, the Spanish troops, despite being outnumbered, were generally far better equipped and far better led than random militia. But the Spanish didn't want to expand their footprint because then the numbers would tell against them. And they just decided to wait for reinforcements. Reinforcements didn't show up. And so eventually the Spanish just packed up and left. So Philip was now 3 for 3 for sending out armadas that had been smashed up by storms while ostensibly under divine protection. And had he learned any lessons? Well, he managed to fall ill and die the following year, so who knows. And so we move on to people who actually had Admiral in their title, and I think you're going to notice a common thread in all of these, which generally boils down to people promoted far beyond their level of competence. So we're going to start off with Admiral Carlton H. Wright of the US Navy. Now, this particular incident occurs partway during the Battle for Guadalcanal. And the Japanese are trying to run supplies down to their soldiers using destroyers. Admiral Wright is put in charge of a unit of US cruisers to which are attached some destroyers and told to stop them. Now, Carlton Wright had been in the US Navy at this point since just before the First World War. However, when you look through his career, you'll notice that pretty much his entire career was spent in some form of specialization in mines or other forms of ordnance and explosive warfare, not in surface command. In fact, when he was placed in charge of this formation, it was only the second time he'd been in command of a group of large surface warships, and his first time in command had been a few weeks earlier. But he went into battle with a plan, and this was actually a plan he himself had helped to draw up. And that plan said that to fight the Japanese at night, given that, well, the first night battle of Guadalcanal, Callahan's night action, hadn't gone particularly well, the idea was that the cruisers should be led into action by the destroyers, and the destroyers would sight the enemy ships, whatever they happened to be. Obviously, under the plan's ideas, they didn't know if they're going to be facing Japanese cruisers, destroyers, or a mix of both. But in any case, the idea was to get close enough to launch the Mark 15 torpedoes that the destroyers carried. Then the destroyers would break away, prepare to fire star shell to illuminate things for the cruisers. And then when the torpedoes hit, or shortly before, the cruisers would open up with their guns, basically making a double punch surprise attack, which would hopefully send the enemy to the bottom in short order. This was a good idea. And then he spectacularly failed to follow it. So during the actual battle itself, the destroyers duly went in, they detected the enemy on radar, and they reported, hey, look, well, we've got their range and bearing, we've got our torpedoes primed and ready to fire, this is an ideal firing solution. The enemy are, however, of course, coming down, heading towards Guadalcanal, and we, of course, are heading roughly north, trying to intercept them. It wasn't a perfect north-south course, but essentially they were on near opposite bearings. And so this fire control solution would only be valid for a few minutes, where you could fire your torpedoes at near enough perpendicular angles ahead of the enemy and they'd run straight into them. So having set all this up and having reported the enemy's course, distance and bearing, the lead destroyer radios back for essentially just the formality to the USS Minneapolis, where Carlton Wright is, and says, well, yeah, can we fire, please? Now, bear in mind that although two of the US cruisers do not have SG radar, Minneapolis is not one of them. She is one of the three US cruisers that does have SG radar. And then Admiral Wright sits around and sits around and sits around. And a couple of minutes later, as the fire control solution is getting worse and worse, as the two units of ships are passing each other, eventually Admiral Wright comes back and says, no, yeah, I don't think the range is actually close enough. He seems to have gotten two things. One, of course, is that the destroyer's commanders actually knew their jobs. They knew what they were doing. They had their own radar. They could see what the range data was, and they knew their torpedoes. And of course, he, although he was part of the same formation on Minneapolis, was something of a distance further back. And so the distance from Minneapolis to the Japanese formation was different to the distance between the destroyers and the Japanese formation. The U.S. destroyer commander very quickly got back on the radio and said, we do know what the range is. It's fine for our torpedoes. And then Admiral Wright waited, and he waited, and he waited. And then eventually he said, well, okay then, fire if you want. So this was now almost 5 minutes after the original request had come in, and with, well, one set of ships heading north and one set of ships heading south, roughly speaking, the fire control solution had gone from near enough ideal to absolutely appalling, because now the Japanese ships were somewhat to the south of the American ships and on a course that was taking them further away still. So the torpedoes would now have to be fired essentially over the shoulder of the American destroyers in a chase position at a very steep angle, where it would take them quite a long time to catch up to the Japanese ships. And they would be fairly easy to evade because, of course, their rate of advance would be whatever their speed was minus the speed of the Japanese destroyers, rather than their speed plus the speed of the Japanese destroyers, which is what you would have had originally. Nonetheless, the torpedoes were in the water, and then having seen that the torpedoes were launched, Admiral Wright not only then immediately ordered his cruisers to open fire, which kind of ruined the element of surprise, which was part, again, of the original plan he himself had drawn up, but they also all decided to violently execute one particular Japanese destroyer out of the quite a few that were on radar. And rather understandably, the Japanese destroyer commander, who was a little bit faster on his feet than Admiral Wright, turned around and just said, okay, you know what, stuff this reinforcement and resupply mission. We're just going to fire torpedoes at things because, well, that's what destroyers do. And of course, in came the long lances. Bang went a lot of American cruisers. Bows fell off. One of the cruisers was sunk. The entire thing was a complete disaster. About the only thing that could be said as a marginal positive was it did at least force the Japanese to abandon the resupply mission. But getting them to abandon a resupply mission and lose a destroyer in exchange for losing a full-on heavy cruiser and getting various chunks blown out of various other heavy cruisers was nothing like close to a reasonable exchange, especially considering that if Admiral Wright had A, trusted his subordinates to know how to operate their radar, and or B, just stuck to his actual original plan, which, as I said, he had written himself in conjunction with Admiral Kincaid, the whole thing could have ended a whole lot better. And although given that morale around the Guadalcanal campaign was precarious at times, the US Navy couldn't be seen to be completely drumming Admiral Wright out of service, they did the next best thing, which was immediately move him to shore duties, from which he was never allowed to emerge, although, as it turned out, while he was on shore duties, supervising various supply and logistics issues back in the continental United States, he was also responsible, as the commanding officer of the area, for the Port Chicago explosion. So if anything, he was incredibly good at blowing up stuff that belonged to the US Navy and not particularly good at blowing stuff up that belonged to anybody else. So understandably, he meets my criteria for one of the worst admirals of all time. Next up, we have Admiral Villeneuve, or to give him his full title, Admiral Pierre-Charles Jean-Baptiste Sylvestre de Villeneuve, from which you might be able to tell he was actually originally an aristocratic French officer, but he managed to, through a combination of actually in some ways genuinely sympathising with the French Revolution and in other ways just wanting to save his own skin, continuing in a naval career despite the fact that most other aristocrats in French naval service either had to flee or be executed. Nonetheless, as a captain, he doesn't seem to have done too badly for himself. I mean, apart from anything, he survived long enough to be promoted to flag rank, which was something of a minor miracle in the revolutionary period French Navy. But having done a, as I said, reasonable job as a captain when he was following somebody else's orders, his first major test when he was in command of a substantial group of warships came at the Battle of the Nile, when he was in command of a portion of the French fleet under the overall command of De Bruy, and when Nelson attacked the French fleet Villeneuve's section of the fleet was the bit that was mostly unengaged. Now, the winds were very light and somewhat contrary, something that would dog him in a much later, much larger battle. But, having said that, Villeneuve doesn't seem to have made any particular move to try and actually help De Bruy, although as a result, his ship was one of the very, very, very few that was actually intact enough to make a run for it at the end of the battle, which is why he was still around a little bit later on. Fast forward to 1804-1805, and he was tasked with assembling a massive Franco-Spanish fleet to clear out the channel, with a plan and a schedule from Napoleon that was worthy both in terms of complexity and in terms of complete unreasonableness in terms of what the sea could actually do, as Philip II's various armada plans. Nonetheless, Villeneuve did a reasonably decent job of the first part, which was to escape from the British blockade, leg it over to the Caribbean, pick up some ships and come back the other way. This bit didn't involve any shooting, and as I said, went reasonably well for them. Then he ran into Admiral Calder's fleet, which was smaller than his, and managed to fight a battle in which Calder captured two ships off of him. The next day, despite both French and Spanish officers urging him to continue the attack because the British had far more damaged vessels than he did, he declined and instead just went off to Cadiz, leaving Admiral Calder the mildly confused but very happy victor of that particular battle. Villeneuve then went on to pick up even more ships and got blockaded into place by Nelson. Napoleon, having concluded that perhaps entrusting the clearance of the channel and the invasion of England to this particular set of vessels and their admiral wasn't the best idea in the world, instead ordered Villeneuve to head into the Mediterranean and raid British shipping there, which Villeneuve failed to do. Napoleon then decided, okay, fine, well, if he can't do his original job and he won't listen to me when I give him a new job, I'm just going to replace him. And he sent a letter to Villeneuve to that effect. Villeneuve realised he was going to be replaced and then decided, oh, actually, you know what, rather than the dishonour of being replaced, I will now retroactively decide to fulfil the orders I've been given previously and order the fleet to sail. However, knowing that Nelson was out there, he appears to have completely lost any idea of how to command. He ordered his ships to leave port in four squadrons. Then he ordered them to form three columns. Then he ordered them into a battle line. Then he decided, no, we're going to go back to three columns again. Then, noticing Nelson was getting disturbingly close, he decided, actually, let's go back to a line. And then, seeing that Nelson was forming up for battle, he decided, actually, you know, stuff this whole going out to sea and fighting Nelson thing. I don't particularly care for it. Let's all turn around and go home. Which resulted in a fleet that had spent the better part of 2 days trying to get out of harbour into some semblance of a formation, eventually ending up in a big loose arc with ships doubled up on each other and ships generally all over the place and completely out of formation, something that Nelson was all too happy to exploit. All this despite the fact that Villeneuve had actually pretty much accurately guessed what Nelson would try and do in any particular confrontation, and the Battle of Trafalgar was of course subsequently lost. Villeneuve was captured, eventually paroled back home to France, and then he at least officially committed suicide by stabbing himself 6 or 7 times in the chest, which, yeah, a lot of people found that a little convenient and more than a little suspicious, because, I mean, stabbing yourself in the chest once is an interesting decision. Continuing on 6 times, that seems unlikely. And so he left a legacy of an admiral who basically lacked the nerve to commit himself to action when he was the one giving the orders, and when he was prompted into a kind of action by mostly the fear of social stigma, he ended up ruining pretty much any chances his fleet might have had by completely stuffing up their formation with mutual contradictory maneuver orders, and thus leading his fleet to a rather disastrous defeat. Something which was not unique to Villeneuve, as we will go on to see. But for our penultimate choice, I'm going to go with Admiral Won Kyung. He was contemporary of the far more famous and far more competent Admiral Yi Sun Shin. The reason he's on this list will require a little bit of explanation. So Admiral Yi and Won Kyung both actually had a very similar origin, starting out as cavalry officers, and in both cases, they actually did pretty decent jobs. Admiral Yi, more through tactics and leadership, and Won Kyung, while he did have a certain degree of tactical brilliance, also was known for being a very front-line commander, charging in at the front with his men to attack the enemy up close. This was all fine and well if you're doing cavalry tactics, but when the Japanese showed up by sea, well, people were called to command navies. At this point, Wonkin showed he was perhaps not the best of admirals, as he completely ignored all reconnaissance, failed to muster his warships in time, the Japanese landed in the area that he had naval command for, and he ended up burning down his own facilities and running away with a handful of surviving ships. This was not necessarily a unique fate for Korean fleets at this point in time, although Wonkin was perhaps one of the worst offenders. Admiral Yi showed up and took in the small surviving remnant of Wonkin's fleet, and then Admiral Yi, with Wonkin as one of his subordinates, began a series of battles against the Japanese, which he won all of, and he gradually managed to rebuild the Korean fleet from a few dozen up to a force of several hundred ships. During these battles, Admiral Yi used plenty of information from his scouts, as well as the significant advantages that the Korean ships had in ranged warfare, both in terms of closer range archery and longer range gunnery. But rather than being happy to be one of the senior officers serving under Admiral Yi, Wonkin, who was slightly older than Yi, decided that actually he would do a much better job of things. Quite how he was going to do a much better job than Admiral Yi, winning multiple battles without losing a single ship, I'm not entirely sure. But anyway, he grew bitter and resentful, thinking he should have all the glory instead. And depending on which source you believe, he either stood back and allowed a conspiracy against Admiral Yi or was actively part of a conspiracy against Admiral Yi. In either case, Admiral Yi was dismissed on false charges after he refused to sail into a very obvious trap, and command of the fleet was given over to Wonkin. So he was now given a battle-hardened Korean fleet that had rebuilt itself from its initial opening disasters. It knew how to fight. It could, if it was led by a competent officer, and it was now stronger than it ever had been before during the entire course of the war. And Wonkin decided that, well, he was going to completely ignore his subordinates, completely ignore his scouts, and sail his fleet into an obvious trap. He lost a couple of skirmishes that led up to said obvious trap, which diminished his fleet somewhat, and then once he had sailed into said obvious trap, decided the best course of action was to just turtle up, literally, and try and get a bit drunk. The Japanese, seeing that the Koreans were now boxed into a corner where they couldn't use their ranged warfare advantage, and that they didn't appear to have done anything in terms of movement or trying to engage for several days, rather understandably decided to sweep down and use their close-range combat advantage to completely overwhelm and destroy the entire Korean fleet, with the only survivors being a small squadron of ships who'd taken one look at Wonkin's decided lack of tactical experience and the destruction he was setting them up for, and just decided, blow this for a game of soldiers, we're out. And that was what would leave poor old Admiral Yi with the task of rebuilding the entire Korean Navy and defending his country with only either a dozen or 13 ships left to his name, basically an even worse position than when he originally started in the first place. I mean, the only thing that Wonkin managed to do correctly was die, and even then it wasn't a death during the battle that he had led his forces so disastrously into. He actually fled ashore, except it turned out there were Japanese soldiers waiting there as well, thanks to the fact he'd been holed up for so long the Japanese were able to land troops on either side of the obvious trap bay and wait for any Korean survivors, which happened to include Wonkin. So he definitely belongs on the list of worst admirals of all time, because he saw exactly how a Korean naval force at this period should be fought. He was part of a good number of those battles. He knew exactly what tactics and strategy Admiral Yi was used, and then, as we said, he either stood by or actively participated in the conspiracy to remove said admiral on trumped-up charges, and then promptly lost the entire fleet, doing exactly the thing that Admiral Yi had said, don't do. And finally, any long-standing viewer of the channel is going to know exactly who's coming up now. It is, of course, Admiral David Beatty of the Royal Navy. Beatty started his naval career as a relatively middling officer, but he managed to distinguish himself in command of gunboats on the Nile and then later on in the Boxer Rebellion as a fairly courageous officer who was pretty good at leadership, and then later on, once he was promoted to captaincy, also pretty good, ironically enough, given future issues, at getting his ships in a clean, efficient working order, and pretty good at gunnery. So far, so good. However, part of the reason he'd got the appointments that he did was because he also had pretty good political connections, and with those political connections also came early promotions, even though he sometimes did his best to sabotage his own career. But as the First World War ensued and Beatty assumed command of the battlecruiser squadron, later battlecruiser fleet, his flaws as a flag officer, where he was the one who had to give the orders rather than just following them, started to become rather apparent. He'd chosen one Ralph Seymour as his flag lieutenant, i.e. the man in charge of turning Beatty's orders into flag signals, mostly for his political connections rather than the fact that he was any good at signalling, which it turned out he actually really wasn't. This became rather apparent at the Battle of Dogger Bank, where a series of conflicting and confusing orders from Seymour meant that although the Royal Navy won the battle, that victory came in the shape of a sunken Blücher and a badly damaged Seydlitz, whereas with a little bit more competent signalling, they could have turned that into at least a sunken Seydlitz and possibly a couple more German ships damaged, if not worse. Beatty, however, refused to do anything about Seymour, and so Seymour would still be with him when he led the battlecruiser fleet augmented by the 5th Battle Squadron into action at the Battle of Jutland. Now, exactly what role Beatty played in the state of the battlecruiser fleet's gunnery during its stay in the Firth of Forth and any subsequent removal with or tampering with of safety features and the various other issues with ammunition, while interesting, are in and of themselves not as germane to the fact that Beatty was a terrible admiral as you might otherwise think. Because even with all those issues, whatever their exact causes happened to be, the simple fact of the matter was that going into the fight, the battlecruiser fleet, together with 5th Battle Squadron, massively outgunned and significantly outranged the German battlecruiser force. And of course, generally speaking, ships only explode when you shoot at them. And if the enemy can't actually get the range to you, well, then they can't shoot at you. However, due to a combination of factors, including Beatty's poor positioning of his flagship, poor choices of orders, and Seymour's even poorer choices in transcribing those orders into flag signals, resulted in Beatty entering the fight, having managed to leave 5th Battle Squadron somewhat behind. You know, the single most powerful naval unit on the entire planet at that point in history. Not the kind of thing you easily miss or allow to roll behind the back of the metaphorical sofa, but nonetheless, that was the case. Now finding the firepower balance somewhat closer than it otherwise would have been, Beatty then proceeded to both overestimate the range to the German ships and issue a series of micromanaging course correction orders to his force, or his remaining force, which resulted in them being far more preoccupied with trying to follow ever-increasingly wild course corrections than actually zeroing in on the German capital ships. And bear in mind, at this stage in the war, every time that your ship made a significant alteration in course or speed, you had to reset your fire control calculations and begin again. Between these technological limitations and the distractions, it meant that the Germans actually got close enough to open fire, and Beatty had thrown away his entire range advantage, and subsequently, of course, Indefatigable and Queen Mary would explode and sink. Then, thanks to further poor signalling, he managed to get 5th Battle Squadron nearly sunk, despite the fact that 5th Battle Squadron had essentially managed to claw its way back into formation and had essentially come to his rescue. He now let them go sailing past his forces, where they promptly got shot at by the entirety of the High Seas Fleet. They then had to double back basically on their own initiative. And during all of this, Beatty had completely failed to actually tell Jellicoe much of anything as to what was going on. Like, are we actually engaging the Germans? How many are the Germans? Where are they and where are they going? Jellicoe, not knowing any of this, had to make most of his decisions either blind or with the reports of Beatty's subordinates, who had just gone over his head and radioed straight back to the Grand Fleet anyway, that being some of the light cruiser squadrons. And then, having come across the Grand Fleet on his way back north after having been thoroughly trounced by Hipper, Beatty decided that instead of tagging on to the bit of the Grand Fleet that he'd come across, which was the tail end of the Grand Fleet, he was going to instead cut across the face of the Grand Fleet and get up to the front, because, of course, the front was the most important position in his view, never mind the fact that it meant that both his ships and the smoke from his ships completely obscured everything that was going on south of them, which meant that the Grand Fleet was blocked off from seeing what the High Seas Fleet was doing for even longer, now that the High Seas Fleet was actually in sight. Having done his very best to lose the Battle of Jutland, subsequent to that, not only would Beatty have some rather, shall we say, interesting and creative inputs into what exactly had caused the problems with his battle cruisers, most of which were aimed at more covering himself than actually addressing the problem, but then after Jellicoe had been promoted to First Sea Lord and the Grand Fleet left in Beatty's hands, Beatty managed to, well, what's the easiest way to put this, almost single-handedly near sabotage the entirety of Anglo-American naval relations in the Second World War. Quite how did he manage to do this at the late end of the First World War, you might ask? Well, it just so happened that one of the American officers who'd showed up, now that America was involved in the war, being that, as we said, it's somewhat later on, was one Ernest J. King, who would later be something of a big deal in the US Navy. Anyway, at this point in time, King was not the world's biggest fan of the British, but he was also fairly eager to see what the main British fleet, aka the world's most powerful naval battle fleet, was like up close and personal, and see whether his initial problems with the British were in fact justified. And this meant he was an observer aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth, which was now Beatty's flagship, and Beatty decided he was going to hold a big naval exercise. He split the fleet in two, with one half under his command, and the other half under the command of Admiral Sturdee. You know, the admiral who'd actually led some British battlecruisers to a decisive victory rather than leading them into an explosive fiery death. A fog descended, which made navigation somewhat difficult, being that this was the era before radar. But nonetheless, Beatty realised that in anything other than a flat calm, and probably even then, Sturdee was by far the better naval officer. And instead of trying to do anything about the fact that Sturdee was probably weaving a trap as they spoke, Beatty just decided to continue onwards. As the fog lifted, it turned out that in fact, yes, Sturdee had developed a rather nice trap. And despite the fact that both fleets had been limited by exactly the same weather conditions, Sturdee had managed to manoeuvre his entire fleet into a position where he had Beatty's half of the fleet completely dead to rights and would, had the war game continued, have, in at least simulated battle, completely annihilated them. Beatty, rather than trying to demonstrate even the mildest degree of technical or tactical prowess in extricating himself from Sturdee's trap, or at least making him pay for it, just decided in a bit of a fit of temper to cancel the entire exercise there and then, so he wouldn't technically have a loss marked on his record. Of course, King, who was on the bridge at the time and observed the entire thing, formed, shall we say, a less than favourable opinion of Britain, the Royal Navy as a whole, since Beatty at this point was supposed to be the epitome of the Royal Navy's commanding officer cadre. And, well, if that was what the cream of the crop was like, then surely King's reasoning went the rest of them must be even worse. Something which, shall we say, would go on to have rather major impacts on how King dealt with the Royal Navy and the British as a whole during the Second World War. And so for the not-so-grand achievement of managing to inflict thousands of completely unnecessary casualties on the Royal Navy in not one but two world wars, whilst ostensibly being a member of said Navy, Admiral Beatty definitely takes the top spot for me as one of the worst admirals of all time.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.